Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
In a shift in its policy toward Israel, the U.S. pushes for an immediate Gaza ceasefire at the UN Security Council. Plus, new signs that U.S. mortgage rates could stay higher for longer.
In the last couple of months, the biggest increase in sales has been for homes that went for more than $1 million, way, way, way above the national average. And we're seeing this in other parts of the economy where people on the lower income spectrum are getting harder hit by higher rates.
And genocide fears resurface in Darfur as the war for control of Sudan rages on. It's Friday, March 22nd. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The U.S. is set to raise its diplomatic pressure on Israel today as it brings a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza up for a vote at the UN Security Council. It marks a shift in Washington's approach to the war in a forum where it has usually defended Israel, and comes as Secretary of State Antony Blinken travels throughout the Middle East to promote a ceasefire that could unlock more humanitarian aid for Gaza. Here he was in Egypt yesterday.
There's a clear consensus around a number of shared priorities. First, the need for an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of hostages. That would create space to surge more humanitarian assistance, to relieve the suffering of many people, and to build something more enduring.
While it is rare for the U.S. to back a U.N. resolution that Israel would oppose, wording in the draft that mentions restarting operations in Gaza after a pause could prompt a veto by Russia or other permanent Security Council members, as could the call that the ceasefire be tied to the release of hostages from Hamas, as Israel has demanded. In Washington, a marathon effort to fund the federal government could be nearing the finish line today, as House lawmakers are expected to pass a $1.2 trillion package of spending bills. That would approve funding for the Defense Department and several other federal agencies for the rest of the fiscal year and wrap up a contentious process that's brought the government to the brink of a shutdown several times. After approval in the House, the Senate would have to agree to speed up the usual timeline for bill consideration in order to prevent a shutdown just after midnight tonight. And facing federal corruption charges, New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez says he won't enter the Democratic primary for his seat this year, but he is leaving open the possibility of an independent re-election bid. Menendez has pleaded not guilty to charges of bribery and conspiring to act as an illegal foreign agent, and he's remaining in office as he contests the charges. However, his announcement signals that he may be bowing to political realities, as state Democrats appear ready to move on from the scandal-plagued lawmaker. Coming up, troubling signs that history may be repeating itself, as our Africa bureau chief shares witness accounts of atrocities committed in Darfur 2 decades after mass killings in Sudan drew worldwide attention. We've got that story and more after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
I lost my ankles and my cadence, so...
There's a lot of loss and a lot of pain.
Yeah, even a lot of pain and a lot of missing.
That was the voice of Hoda Hamza, a refugee from Sudan's Darfur region, which is in the throes of a civil war. And her story is just one in a grim pattern of atrocities perpetrated by mostly Arab fighters against the region's black indigenous communities over the past 11 months. Officials say these acts are a continuation of the mass killings in Darfur 2 decades ago and are being revived amid a broader war for control over Africa's third largest country. The Journal's Africa Bureau Chief Gabrielle Steinhauser has spoken to more than 4 dozen refugees, as well as aid workers, diplomats, and international experts who are monitoring the violence in Darfur and documenting abuses against civilians on an industrial scale. Gabrielle, I imagine many listeners will be aware of the genocide in Darfur 20 years ago. Tell us, though, what has happened there more recently.
So what happened was that last April, we saw a war breaking out between Sudan's top 2 generals, one commanding the military, the other one commanding this militia known as the Rapid Support Forces, which is basically a successor to the Janjaweed that a lot of listeners may remember from that earlier genocide in the early 2000s. So these two guys with their respective fighting forces are battling for control in Sudan. Now, in Darfur, which is this region in Western Sudan, this war has kind of created an opening for what's a lot of people watching this say is really a continuation of the atrocities that we witnessed in the early 2000s, which the U.S. considers a genocide.
Gabrielle, you have spoken to dozens of people in refugee camps, and your reporting seems to suggest some of the details about how systemic killings and other atrocities are being carried out. What are you hearing?
Right. I mean, we went to interview refugees in refugee camps in Chad, just across the border from Darfur, and it was just striking. You randomly walk up to somebody, and pretty much everybody has some horrible story. They've either lost a relative, some people had been shot themselves, some people had been beaten themselves. It's just that the scale that was so incredibly striking. I mean, these are not sort of random acts of cruelty, but really well-organized acts that the U.S. government has said amount to ethnic cleansing, deliberate attacks on women, on children, on civilians. So we've spoken to women who were raped, who were beaten, who were shot point blank while fleeing with their children on their backs or holding their hands. And this militia at the center of this, the Rapid Support Forces, it's the successor of the Janjaweed. And the way they're going about this really seems to be informed by their experience of the early 2000s. Almost every refugee I spoke to, they had their phones stolen. And yes, this is part of looting for financial gain, but it's also a way of destroying evidence, of avoiding footage of atrocities and the people who committed them, filtering out to the wider world. I also spoke to experts who use satellite images to document atrocities, and they're saying in several cases, it seems like the RSF was taking advantage of cloud cover to perpetrate attacks. They also regularly knock out civilian communications. So there really seems to be a concerted effort to stop the world from seeing what is happening in Darfur.
Gabrielle, the details that you've picked up on in your conversations with people fleeing Darfur and the fact that this is in some ways a run back of what occurred 20 years ago, I think, is hard to stomach. Why is the international community not more aware of this conflict?
I think in many ways, there's just a bit of an atrocity fatigue. We have 2 very big high-profile conflicts taking place at the same time. There's obviously Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There's Israel's war in Gaza following the terrorist attacks of October 7th. And that is taking up a lot of oxygen.
Gabrielle, what consequences is that lack of attention on the part of the international community having on the ground?
I mean, any aid organization you speak to will tell you that they're having an extremely hard time raising funds to help those refugees who've actually made it out of Sudan, as well as the millions of people who've been displaced inside Sudan. The World Food Program warned just last week that if they don't get more funding, they will have to stop food aid in Chad to Sudanese refugees as early as April. So that's just in a couple of weeks. And that would take us back really to the situation that Huda and others experienced when they first arrived in Chad, where there was just nothing. And the only people who were around to help them was the Chadians who were already living in these villages that were suddenly flooded by refugees desperately fleeing these atrocities.
In that time, I saw there's no life at all because I haven't even a cup of water to give my children. But, you know, the community which exists here, you know, so kind.
Gabrielle, given that you've now documented that these atrocities are happening and we can hear from some of the people who've experienced them, is it clear what the outlook from here could be? Is there any indication your reporting, some of the awareness that's trying to be drummed up here could have an effect, could possibly change things?
Well, I do think that there is finally a little bit more attention being paid to what is happening in Darfur and Sudan more broadly. So the US just announced a special envoy who's now traveling the region to find avenues for negotiations, for serious peace negotiations. We also have a resolution in the Senate by a bipartisan group of senators who want to recognize the current atrocities as another genocide. And after the article was published yesterday, I got a message from one of the aides of one of these senators, and he's passing around this article to raise awareness and get people on board for taking action. As for the warring parties themselves, I haven't seen any serious signs that they are open to actually ending this war. They seem committed to fighting this out until one of them wins. So I fear that what we're going to see just, you know, in the coming weeks and months is more human suffering at a moment when millions of people are, according to the United Nations, on the brink of famine.
Gabrielle Steinhauser is the Wall Street Journal's Africa Bureau Chief. Gabrielle, thank you so much for bringing us this story and making us aware of the situation there.
No, thank you for giving it some more airtime. I appreciate it.
Mortgage rates in the U.S. are likely to remain higher than most people are expecting, despite indications from the Fed that interest rates will come down later this year. Federal mortgage lender Fannie Mae is now predicting that rates on a 30-year fixed will stand at 6.4% by the end of the fourth quarter, an increase from its prior view of 5.9%. Alex Frangos is a Journal finance editor.
Everyone's hoping to get back to the good old days of before the pandemic when mortgage rates were impossibly low. Part of the reason they were so low was that the Fed was buying mortgage bonds, you know, artificially suppressing the market. And we know that the Fed is not going to be doing that anytime soon. And so as the market normalizes, the Fed rate cuts, they will cause mortgage rates to come down, but they're not going to come down as fast as they would have previously.
Yesterday's home sales data revealed a pickup in the overall housing market, albeit primarily for sales in homes worth over $1 million, as high interest rates continue to disproportionately affect lower-income households. The number of Airbnbs available in New York has dropped dramatically over the past 6 months since the city put in place short-term rental rules. Hosts now have to go through a lengthy process in order to register their properties with the city and get a license. And as travel reporter Allison Poley explains, that means that visitors have fewer options if they're looking for a short-term rental for their stay.
There are so many legal challenges to getting this type of regulation in place. And Airbnb and the city went back and forth in court for years before this actually went into effect. They have said that they hope the city revisits the regulations, but they've also said that no one city makes up a large portion of their revenue because they do business in so many places. People are confused. There's just like a dramatic drop in the number of listings available. People don't think necessarily to look at Airbnb in the city anymore, or if they do, they find such limited options. So if people aren't considering Airbnb for their New York travels, then that could affect the way that they approach staying in a short-term rental when they travel to various cities.
New York's Office of Special Enforcement has approved approximately 1,700 short-term rentals, and some 3,000 are still under review. And before we go, a heads up that we've made a correction to last night's episode. In that show, we incorrectly said that 17 states were involved in the Justice Department's antitrust suit against Apple, when in fact 15 states and the District of Columbia had joined the suit. And that is What's News for Friday morning. Today's show was produced by Charlie Duffield and Kate Bullivant. Our supervising producer is Sandra Kilhoff, and I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. We will be back tonight with a new show. Otherwise, have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.